I'm Nadav Aharoni. I just recently graduated from the MIT Media Lab, finished my PhD there. This talk is about investigating social mechanisms with mobile phones. And these are the hashtags for the talk. And again, if you like it, please rate it in the app, but only if you like it. So let me start with a little opener. So in the medical realm, MRI is one of the best technologies that we have for diagnosing a living person. We can actually use it to look into the person and image it in 3D, image them in 3D, and...
You still can't hear me.
Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. How about now? Okay. So, the other... If we had some volume help, then that would be good. Okay, so... Okay now for everybody, hopefully? Good. So we have MRI... And we have functional MRI on the other end, which is today one of the leading ways, the leading way to actually look at functions inside the brain, where somebody inside an MRI machine is being stimulated while and then being measured. And this is our way to actually look at how functions work in the brain in a living person. And the analogy is, what if we could do this for an entire community? What if we could actually do it, not in an imaging chamber, but as they live their lives? Image a community from all the directions and understand what's going on from many aspects. But what if we could also, like the social fMRI, give a stimulus and then actually measure how it affects the community while they're doing it and look at the before and after? So one way to do this would be to, you know, put a little dome above a city. Sorry if you can hear me. So one approach is to build a big dome and ask them to live under it for a few years and, you know, and the other approach is to use mobile phones. So our mobile phones right now are wearable computing and sensing platforms that can sense almost everything around us and around them, about the user, about their environment, and what you're doing with the phone itself. So from temperature to networks around you, to apps that you're running, to inferring your activity. And in aggregate, we can actually use a lot of cell phones in a community to sort of build a virtual imaging chamber to look at the life of the community. With their consent, of course. So we call this approach social mechanism design and relationship imaging, which amazingly comes to social MRI. And the idea is to use ubiquitous sensors like mobile phones, but other types of signals like financial activity, social media, and self-reports of people with surveys to actually construct this imaging chamber of the life of that community. In analogy, we also have the social functional MRI, the social fMRI, which actually allows us, it's an experimental approach that allows us to stimulate the community while we measure it and actually look at their response. So I'm coming from a research group at the Media Lab called the Human Dynamics Group, led by Professor Alex Sandy Pentland, who's one of the pioneers in wearable computing and mobile sensing. And the general objectives of the group are to sense, learn, and act on social systems. Like I said, this work is a lot of my PhD research that I just recently graduated, but with a lot of other contributors and collaborators and friends, and I tried to note that wherever I could. In general, we're going to talk about the high-level approach of how to do this and why this is important, the system that we've built, the experimental study that we've conducted for over a year and a half, experimental results, and the open-source tools that are coming out of this. So generally about the approach, I'm going to talk a little bit about the context and our motivation to do this, and some related work. I'm going to try not to make it too scientific, but I think on purpose I left the citations at the bottom if somebody wants to go to further reading and understand this topic, these topics better, and these slides will be public after the talk. So computational social science is an emerging field where we're trying to actually change the way social sciences are done, psychology, sociology, economics, and the point is that we... Yes. Thank you. Sorry. So using digital tools, we're actually able to quantify and measure societies and individuals and even whole countries in a breadth that we could never do before. Instead of having researchers ask questions and field surveys, there are a lot of inaccuracies in surveys that people from the field know about. There are a lot of other problems to actually ask questions to thousands of people. And usually until now it's been very manual work and hard labor. But with phones and digital sensing, we can actually open up and sense thousands of people or even millions. But there's still a growing field, and there's a huge need for tools and methodologies and technologies to actually do this. And today, one of the big jobs, if you look at the job market, is the data scientist. And, you know, these artisans that are experts that can dig into a database and find you the gold in it, and this is probably one of the sought-after jobs. But one of the things that we're trying to do is democratize that, is actually enable more people to be data scientists and actually make it sort of like an engineering field, that you can learn it in school and actually get into it much better and broaden the number of people that are actually using and understanding big data. What's been done until now, one of them to get data for computational social science is sort of donations or collaborations from companies. So companies, it's very hard to collect data from millions of people, but a lot of telecommunication companies, finance companies, Facebook, they have data on millions of people. And so they donate some of that data to researchers. Most times it's anonymous. But even though it's anonymous and aggregated, it's still been helpful, very helpful for us to understand humanity better. In particular, mobile communication has been, and mobile phone traces have been used to actually look at how societies live in large. But there's still problems with this because you don't know these people, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit. From the other end, there's the ground-up approach, which is using from the individual outward. So the idea of reality mining came out of our research group a few years ago by Eagle and Pentland, and the idea is to actually use a mobile phone as a social sensor. And the initial experiment in 2005 actually collected data from about 100 people for a few months and tried to just also show the concept that you can use a phone to collect more reliable results than a survey. If you ask people how much time you spent with friends in the last week, people really don't recall it well. But the phone can actually remember these things much better than us. And they actually demonstrated that you can do that, and it started the whole era of mobile-based sensing and human sensing. And the data set, the original data set, which is, again, only a few signals collected, they collected a little bit about the Bluetooth and the proximity of phones to one another and what cell tower they're at. It's been already used in the community to do over 100 different research papers and actually understand how disease spreads and model mobility of people. And this has sort of just opened up this whole field. But the existing approaches are a bit limited. So although they've been amazing and getting us a lot of interesting insight into us, most of them are offline, especially data sets coming from companies. So it's offline. You can't actually ask a question and then measure it again. The data is very constrained. A phone company only has phone records. Facebook knows what you're doing online, but not offline. Your credit card company knows another type of limited set of financial activity, but not anything else. The other type of challenge is that if you actually want to do a scientific experiment, you want to set the variables and you want to actually isolate them and measure them. You can do it in a lab, but it's very hard to do in the real world. It's very noisy. It's very hard to actually measure something in the real world and do an experimental design that will actually be valid. And you can actually make conclusions that are not noise or things that you are not in control of. So what we're trying to do with this idea of the social fMRI is to help resolve some of these issues. So we have two main components. One is, like I mentioned, the imaging component, which extends the idea of reality mining. If we had two or three or four signals in the beginning, now we have tens of signals that we can collect with a phone, creating a very rich and highly dimensional data set that can collect data continuously when you're holding the phone. Battery technologies have improved a lot. And again, there's the functional discovery part. We can actually build a methodology to how to design an experiment in the real world, measure it in a fairly accurate way, and then actually have conclusions that are valid. The benefit of doing rich data is that the same type of data that you collect from the phone can actually be used at the same time to answer a lot of research questions. We can look at social health and wellness of people. We can look at the identity. Who are my friends and what makes me what I am based on my friendships and my relationships? We can look at dynamics in a community, how people influence one another. We can actually try to actually quantify social capital. And we can also look at how things diffuse in the community. And things can be flu, and we can actually measure how flu spreads from one person to another, or ideas. So we can actually look at ideas and behaviors spread in the network. And of course, we also want to use this to investigate issues of privacy and trust, which is a very important field to us. But if we want to summarize all of this, the top-level research questions are how people make decisions, and how can we, and especially the social aspect of it, and how can we help them make better decisions in their life and give them personal and social tools to improve their lives. So the main benefits of this approach is that it allows us to actually do, in the real world, understand these properties of networks, how friendships are forming and evolving, and how just actually build models for the real world based on the real world and not based on what people are doing online. It opens the door for better causality, which is really important to actually see we did an action and had a result. and we can actually design new mechanisms, test them with a community, and see how they change their behavior. So the system that we've built, in high level, we have a very strong personal and personal data logging component. Like I said, the mobile phone and Facebook, and we also have our own sort of apps that collect more data. Like we built our own alarm clock app that actually saves the snooze times that people do, so we can actually look at what's the connection between how many snoozes you need to your stress levels and to what you do in your life. We also ask people for purchasing behavior, about from credit card statements to different individual receipts that they have. And this has actually helped us to understand decision points in their lives. We don't care about marketing better to them, but if my behavior changes after I have a baby and it's really similar to my friend, we could actually infer that. And we could actually look at times where people change their behavior and try to infer who they learned that from or why they changed their life. We also had surveys on the phone that actually gave us the ground truth of what people were really feeling or doing. And for a component, we also have body measurements. So we have their status of body mass and fat and things like this. On the phone itself, we've built the software framework that you can run on Android phones, which collects tens of signals, like I mentioned. We call each signal a probe, because these signals are, these could be sensors, but they could be other things, as I'll mention in a second. We also can push surveys to the phone. We also have other apps that can talk to this framework and also help it collect data for them, for us. And we can also push updates remotely, and we can remotely configure and tweak everything. So if we know, for example, there is a community barbecue, we can turn on all the listening for that few hours, spend a bit more battery, but get really fine-grained motion and what people are doing in that event. And all of it is flowing to our back end. So this is just an example. It's on purpose, it's a bit overwhelming, but these are about 25 to 30 signals that we collected in the experiment that I'm going to talk about, plus the surveys. Specifically, just to give you some examples. So the phones have a Bluetooth device, and they can do Bluetooth scans, which was originally meant for devices to discover one another. But because we know the phone IDs of all the people in the study, we can actually infer that two people have been in close proximity to one another or together. So we can actually use Bluetooth as a face-to-face sensor and actually sense what people are doing together and the times that they're spending together. A Wi-Fi scan, again, was originally intended to help you find better access points, but we can actually use it to infer that people are in the same location and where they are. And the advantage of Wi-Fi over GPS is that it's very, very battery efficient. It doesn't cost us much. So we can actually listen on the phone wherever Wi-Fi scans are being performed, and we can actually help make better location for the person without spending battery. We also track mobile applications, what people are installing and what people are running. And again, we care less about marketing, but we actually use a mobile app as a decision point. The fact that I chose to install an app, and 2 days later my friend chooses to install the same app, might mean something. And we can actually look if these decisions are random or they can be socially connected. So if we look at our backend structure, so every phone is actually saving data all the time, and they're actually saving it in many, many small files. So in case one of them gets corrupted, we don't lose all that much data. And then we have a backend server that actually aggregates all of it and pushes it into a single live database. And I'm saying live because, like I said, this is a live experiment. So you can do analysis and reports and write papers, but you can also build apps that run on top of the data as it's being collected. We also had automatic notifications that were sent to us. So if a phone wasn't uploading for a week, we can actually get an email and not find it out at the end of the experiment. So we can actually have sort of a live feel of what's going on in the study. And we also use, this is an example of data visualization that was shown to some of the participants, showing them their own data, and actually we could measure how seeing your own data affects your behavior. And if we move on to the actual study that we did, it was called the Friends and Family Living Laboratory. And so this is all about a housing community of graduate student families versus undergraduate communities or coworkers that where a lot of academic research has been done. This is sort of a living community. So everybody there is a family. Half of them have kids. They have day-to-day troubles. They have to earn money. They're not dependent on parents or something like this. There's very vibrant community life in this community. They have shared events and facilities where they meet. There's a playground and a barbecue area. And there are a lot of sub-communities in this community. So we have people from the same country, we have people from the same department, people in the same age or same floor, but we know all of that. It's not just random dots that we got from a cell phone company. We know exactly their communities because they told us. So we can actually see how these affect their behavior. But this study is actually not our study. This is a study from 1946, which is called Social Pressures in Informal Groups, which is by Leon Festinger and his collaborators. Leon Festinger was actually the person who invented terms like cognitive dissonance and things like this, and he's a very famous social psychologist. And he was doing one of the first living laboratory experiments at MIT in the 40s. And this is a community that was made for World War II veterans coming back to MIT after the war. Now they were married and had families, and they came to finish their studies. So they had very similar concepts to what we have today. They investigated social networks, how things spread in a network, and even the collection methodologies and how to improve them. So this is some... These are some results from their own study. One of the interesting things is it was one of the first studies ever that used matrices to represent social networks. Now, if you've ever done any social network understanding, matrices is the traditional and usual way to represent them, but they actually had to spend a whole chapter in the book to explain why this is useful. So this is like really the groundbreaking. They even spread fake rumors. They actually injected a fake rumor in the community that, you know, some news crew is coming to interview people. And they actually later interviewed others and saw how the rumor spread in the community and tried to predict who would tell who that rumor. So even then, they were talking about the challenges of how diverse it is to collect such data in the real world and how challenging it is. And it requires the battery of tools that the scientist has. But they also had differences from today, because they only interviewed the women, because they were the burden of social life, while the men had to work and study. So it shows us some of the differences in the way we see things today. And if you move to the future, back to today, so our experiment was done in exactly the same community 60 years afterwards. And the buildings are newer, they moved a little bit to the side, but it's the same type of community for graduate research student families with all the parameters that I described. If we look at the layout of the community, so it has sort of a joint playground in the middle and several buildings and shared facilities like laundry rooms and things like this where people meet. And we conducted this study for 15 months with 140 unique individuals. And the general approach was to first observe, look at the community and what's happening, and after we know them, actually do positive interventions and actually design experiments with the community. So for the first 6 months, we had a pilot with 55 people where we tested our technologies, and then we added, you know, 130, we upped it to 130 more people where we actually did different interventions that I'm going to describe. So we did, this is an example of the interventions we did. We had a fitness game that I'm going to describe in more detail as an example. We had the Fun for Data, which is sort of our intervention of showing people their own data and looking at how this affects them. We had a sleep study as well. And we had an app stimulus where we actually at some point gave them, you have $30 and 2 weeks to spend it on mobile apps. So we sort of shook the system and saw how they learned from each other how to spend that money. Privacy and subject protection are one of the most important things, you know, in a study like this, and especially for us. And I think being academia, we could do things that a company could not do. And we came to this from the perspective of helping the individuals and improving science and understanding humanity better. We're not coming into this to try to make, again, better advertising technologies. So there's every university experiment is actually supervised by an ethics committee, which is the institutional review board. So we actually have to adhere to a lot of things that companies would not have to. And everything is done with informed consent with the participants, so they actually know what is being collected, what it's going to be used for, and at any time they can come and ask for their data to be deleted, which nobody has in our experiment. There are two boundaries that we've set. The first one is very traditional, between the investigators and the outside world, which means we are not allowed to publish anything that would identify a participant. But we also set another barrier, which is between us and the participants. We actually never collected any human-readable data. We have scrubbed out all the numbers and all the text, and it was never even saved on the phone, because we didn't even want to have to touch this data. And now my own data was part collected in this data set as well, and I wanted to make sure that I'm comfortable with it. So I sort of went through this like a guinea pig myself, and all of my data from that year and a half is there as well. So whatever is done with this data set, I want to feel comfortable with it. And we use this as a dissection lab to understand privacy and to actually improve privacy technologies. Just to give you an example, this is a regular call log. I don't know if you can see, but so we can actually take the phone number and make a one-way encryption. So the phone number is scrubbed into something that not readable by humans, but it's always going to be encoded in the same number. So if the same person is calling the same number 10 times, it's going to be the same code. And if 5 people in the community call the same number, it's going to be the same code. The next stage is to actually summarize. You know, this person had 25 calls to this number in this year, and this is their average length. And another level of aggregation is just saying, we inferred that this user is a student and they like sports based on this data. And soon, all of these technologies, based on this research, is going into the phone. So the phones could actually do this inference and then expose that data to apps without having to expose the raw data and with all the risks that are involved in this and privacy invasion. So the strong points of the study is it's probably the highest richness study ever made to date as far as the dimensions and the resolution we collected, and the fact that it was a live laboratory and we could actually adjust the experiment as we went along. I'm going to show you a few just sample results from this experiment, starting with the imaging chamber, and then I'll talk about the intervention and social mechanism part. Just some statistics. So we have over 1 million hours of human data collected in this time, over 117 years of data. We have over 60 gig of collected sensor data, 30 million individual scans. So we have, 14 million accelerometers. So it's about 53 years of human movement. We have 240 million access point scans, 16 million Bluetooth devices scanned, 200,000 phone calls. So just to give you some examples, we also had the Facebook component, which was opt-in. So 99 users opted in. And again, we have over 2,000 friendship information from that group. We also have, like I said, the background information. We actually know the age spread in the community. We know the genders. We know the number of children that they have, the religious affiliation, the MIT affiliation, if they're students or a spouse of a student, their ethnic group. And this is really going to help us try to look at how things spread based on these parameters, which are very hard to get if you just did it from an anonymized data set. Another thing, if two people are connected in a relationship, there are many types of relationships, right? So there's the colleague and somebody could be both a colleague and a neighbor of one another. Another person could be, they might have a shared activity like going to the gym together, and another person might be their spouse. And this is an actual person from the study. And for the spouse, for example, which again is a real person, we know that she's a homemaker with eight other participants that we had in the pilot. She has kids, like 30 other participants. She's part of the same religious group as 18 other participants. She lives on a certain floor, and now we can actually use this information to see how she talks to these people and how their behavior is changing compared to hers. There's also, in the same way that there are many types of relationships, there are many ways to span a network between the same people. So if we look at this data, this is actually, for the same participants, this is their Bluetooth network, this is their Facebook network, this is their self-reported friendships. We actually asked them how they feel about every other participant, and we actually did this several times so we can see how these feelings evolve over time. And we have the phone call network. And like I said, the Bluetooth is the proxy for face-to-face and online activity and self-perception. And what we can see immediately is that these networks are very, very different. If you just did your analysis based on phone calls or based on online activity, it's going to be a very partial part of the picture and not necessarily the most important part of the picture. We can see how face-to-face network is very rich. We can see how influentials in one network are not influentials in the other, while other ones rise. So different networks are being used by us for different types of communication and behavior. But also, when I'm saying a network, what is a network? What do I need to actually put a line between two people? Is it that they spent 1 minute with each other or 1 hour with each other? So it's very flexible of how to fine-tune a network. And whenever you see somebody talking about a social network, you have to ask them how they actually drew those lines and what was the threshold for making a line. This is an example of another way to make a network. So this is, the colored dots are actually our people, and these other tan dots are anonymized numbers that are not in the study that we don't know about. But we can see, for example, that these two people called the same number. And we can actually connect them in some way, and otherwise we would never have known that they are linked to each other. Another benefit of this approach is that we actually have all of this over time. So we can actually look at how people integrate into the community. We can actually look at the network parameters change, how many friends on average per person has. And we can see how it's changing over time and how the network is evolving. And we have all that data. I'll give you an example of what you could do with this just for one type of signal. This is the location. And again, it's a heat map that shows you where the person has been. Every frame is a single day over a month. This is the MIT campus, actually. And this is the dorm area, and this is sort of the laboratory areas. And you see that you don't know where he is, but you see generally where he's spending his time. And this person is spending all of his time at home and at work. At home and at work, if you can see. And maybe stopping at the gym here, but also there's some fast food around there, so you don't know what he was actually doing. If you look at another person from the same community, this is the same community, the same month. You can still see they're hanging a lot of around the same dorm area or the community area, but they're going all over the place. And this is like a Galleria, this is a mall, this is Harvard Square, so they're moving around. if you just looked at people as particles and you could calculate their average movement and things like this, but if I just told you one is a student and one is a spouse, you could immediately know who is who. So this is part of the benefit of having some context information about the data that you have. Because this data is so complicated, we actually have to develop our own tools. So we actually developed our own visualization tools and analysis tools to look at the network. So this is, again, a tool that we developed, and it allows us to actually spread the network and look at different types of relationship. Its color is a different type of relationship. And we can actually spread them out and actually look at the data over time and understand the evolution of communication in that community. So this is just showing an example of that tool. And now I'm going to give you a few samples of some of the results that came out of it and why this is interesting. So we took it in different directions, in fitness, in the direction of looking at health and sleep, looking at network effects and applications, and trying to look at influence. I'll start with this. This is an example of, for our pilot data, when we had 55 people, in 3 months, they installed over almost 900 apps, 900 unique apps from the Android market. And these graphs actually show sort of a sanity check. This is users per app and apps per user. So we can see here on this, it's a logarithmic graph, you can actually see that a few apps have almost 50 users. Almost the whole community installed those apps. These are apps like Pandora, for example, or let's say the MIT shuttle service that almost everybody around has it. But there are more rare apps that are more interesting, because if there's an app here that only 5 people installed, we can actually see, do these 5 people know each other, or are these just randomly spread in the community? We can look at the other way. We can actually look at how many apps each user installs. We can see that most users have about 10 apps in that period, but we had actually a few explorers who had over almost 100 apps that they installed. So what happens when somebody who has 100 apps is connected to somebody who has few apps? Are they teaching them? Are they learning from them? And things like this. So if we look at the key findings that we have from apps so far, we can actually see that app diffusion patterns do spread through social interactions. And we can actually see, in particular, the face-to-face network is really important. We can see that the more time people spend face-to-face, the more apps they have in common. And it's not necessarily connected to the fact that they declared were friends or not. The self-reported friendship is actually not a predictor. We actually saw it the opposite. So if we look at the actual numbers, and I'm just going to focus on these highlights in red, in the face-to-face sense, you have about 2.7 apps in common with strangers, but 5 apps in common with people that you've spent about an hour or more in the proximity for over in a duration of a month. So it could be that our children are playing together in the playground, and I'm just next to you, or I see you on the shuttle, and you're still influencing me more than a friend that I said he's a good friend of mine. If we look at the people that you said are good friends of yours, you have about 4 apps in common, but you actually have more in common with strangers that you didn't say are your friends. You have almost 5 apps in common with strangers. So we can see that this is not a predictor. We actually used this to take all these types of networks that I described and actually build a better algorithm to predict app installation. So we can actually combine multiple networks and create one merged network to do all of that together. And so there's some more information in those publications, but again, this is not the main focus that we're doing. The main takeaway is that your declared friends don't necessarily influence you as much as you or viral marketers may think. You know, if you think about Facebook, it's a declared network. It's more about the people you physically spend time with, even if you don't consider them your friends, which I think is a very interesting result. If we go to the sleep and mood aspect, you know, we want to ask, what is the connection between the sleep that you had and your mood in the next day, or your mood today and the sleep that you're going to have, and how you socialize with others? Can we actually use the phones to predict this, and can we actually use the phones, these parameters, to predict one another? If you had a bad day of sleep, can we predict your mood, or things like this? So we did sort of a check. So like I said, we had a sort of a sleep study part of the study, and we have data about self-reported sleep. Everybody said in the morning how long they slept. We have automatically sent information about their movement and about their clock and alarms. And we also have, for 20 people, we actually have detailed sleep results. We actually let them sleep with a Zio device. We actually measure your sleep waves. And we also have other measures like personality and things like this in the study. So the key interesting thing is, yes, we can see a significant connection between your sleep and your mood. In particular, your mood is most affected by your own sleep pattern and your spouse's mood. So a bit of common sense as well. And we also can see the connection with socialization. But one of the interesting results is that using just the automatic measurements, we can find results that fit what's in the medical journals for a healthy population. So we can actually demonstrate that we can use these phones to collect data over time over a whole community and actually look and help track their sleep patterns and mood. And if things change, we can actually maybe alert the person or their friends or somebody. And again, all of this should be with consent, but we can see that we can actually do this in mass with automatic technologies. Now, going to the mechanism design part. So we had FunFit, which is our fitness-centered social intervention. What we did, we structured this as a wellness game. We actually told people that their goal is to increase their activity level over time, and they'll get rewarded for it. But our real goal was to measure aspects of motivation and incentive. So we had three groups in the study. Our control group got... We used the phones to measure their physical activity, and they got to see their physical activity results, and they got rewarded for their activity. But we care about the social part. So we actually had another group that saw two other friends, and two different friends saw them. So you have this social information flowing. You can see how people train and what they do, and it might influence you as well. And our third mechanism was actually that you get rewarded for your friend's behavior and not your own. And your behavior actually goes to two other people. So sort of you have this social incentive to convince your friends to train more if you want. So it's sort of a game, but we wanted to try this mechanism. And just saying gamification, which is a really hot word today, it's not enough. Just saying to make something social doesn't guarantee results because people can actually demotivate each other. A whole group that doesn't exercise will actually demotivate you as well. Competition is not always good. If you're very far behind, you'll actually stop playing the game after a while. And again, if you, the idea is to go with people's habits rather than give them new ones. You can't just tell people, wear your phone in this pocket so we can measure your steps accurately. You have to just let them wear the phone wherever they want and still give good enough results. And again, these people did not sign up for a fitness game. They signed up for this just, I'm getting a free phone and I'm just using it in my life. Which is great because this gives us a real community. It's not people who opted in to a fitness game or a fitness startup trial, an alpha test. Because they're already biased because they chose to participate in that game. So here we just give it to everybody. So we had a different range of attitudes. Not everybody in our group even thought that they need to get better fitness or lose weight. We wanted to be unobtrusive. So we had to use all of this in our design considerations. So that's why we designed this as a non-competitive game. It's sort of you're only competing with yourself and not with others. So we lose that part of competition. We also wanted to make sure everybody has the same reward potential. We can't have a group not getting any money and another group getting a lot of money, right? Because they know each other, they live in the same community, they'll just stop playing the game. So we had to make sure everybody has the potential to earn the same amount of money. And we also decided on a less accurate way to measure steps and measure physical activity, but that works in more cases, that no matter where you wear your phone, we get your activity. And the general idea is that we wanted to get a score of general activity levels. So if you take the stairs more than the elevator, you could actually see your score go up. But we don't care about counting exact steps. So another thing, for example, again, this is just examples of challenges of if you're actually doing something like this in the real world versus in the lab. Not everybody has data plans. How do you get the data in time to give them their reward? So we actually had some game mechanics in our app to actually make them want to push an upload button and sync our data to us or connect to the Wi-Fi and sync it to us. We decided on sort of like a three-day reward so that if they didn't sync in a day, we could still play the game with them. We also decided there are no zero rewards. For example, again, even if you didn't do anything, you got 50 cents for those 3 days, just so people don't get demotivated. We also decided to do it as a network structure versus a team. So if we had a team, people would want to maybe reciprocate for one another, right? If I train and my friend earns money for that, then I might want to train to give him back because, you know, it's friendship. So we wanted to take that away. We wanted to make my training affect somebody, but his training affects somebody else, which is more like maybe real life. So we actually used the data that we had on our pilot and before we started this experiment to decide how to divide these groups. So we actually wanted to spread the groups so that they'll have some close friends and some random strangers, and we actually have that information, which you wouldn't have in another experiment. If you just collected this for a fitness study, you wouldn't have all that information necessarily about their behavior in real life before it started. So we actually look at our graph and try to split it evenly. We wanted to make sure nobody is going to be paired with their spouse. We wanted to make sure that you don't have cycles and things like this. So this is an example of the power that we had this information beforehand. So out of the community, about 108 people participated in this game. Out of 120 that we had at the time, we divided them into the control and two other experimental groups. Some of them had to drop out because their phones were broken or they spent the semester abroad, so they couldn't participate in the game. But generally what we did is, for the first few weeks, We didn't even tell them they're in the game. We just measured their activity. And then we told them the game started. So we actually had their baseline of how they behave before changing their behavior for the game. And then we continued for about 7 or 8 more weeks with the game, but we threw away the first half. Because in the beginning of the game, you're excited. You do more than you would maybe later. So we actually really focus on analyzing what happens after 2 months of being in this game. So if I show you one result, I'm going to focus on what we call reward efficiency. So like I said, we paid the money, about $5, up to $5 every 3 days. And we had the different groups. And we wanted to see how far does our dollar go. You know, the dollars we paid each person versus the change in activity from before and after. And if we look at that, we can actually see very clearly that the non-social group was less than half than the other social groups. So the social component has a very strong effect on their behavior. And within the social groups, the one that had sort of the social pressure part, or the incentive, was almost double the first one. And if we make it into numbers, then all of our participants, you know, the control group itself had about a 3% increase in their daily activity. The second group had 5% increase, and the other one has about 10% increase in their physical activity. But this also includes holidays and Thanksgiving and nighttime. This is general increase in activity. And if we take the best group, the peer reward, we had an added 84 minutes of movement per week. And you have to remember, this is in New England in the fall. If we did this experiment from January to May here, you know, then people would say people are moving more because it's springtime and it's getting warmer. For us, we started in October and ended in December, so actually it was the New England winter, and they actually moved more in the winter when it was snowing than before it started snowing. So the key observations here are that social components have a very significant effect on real-world behavior. We can see that this new mechanism we tried got us the highest reward efficiency, and that we saw different interesting interaction effects. For example, if you were paired with two strangers or two people that you knew, it was okay. But if you had one stranger and one person that you didn't know, one friend and one stranger in your team, it was very bad performance. So we're analyzing this a bit more to understand this a bit better. But it's interesting, so now we have another sort of thing to add to the toolbox of fitness-related games. So this moves us to the part of sharing all the stuff that we've done so far. So we decided after having this deployed and built in the field to actually share this and turn this into an open source framework for sensing. So we call it FUNF, Open Sensing Framework, and the idea is to be extensible and open source and reusable set of functionalities that others can use and build on. The core team for this is me and Sandy Pentland and Alan and Cody, who are also here. And the general idea is that we're trying to target several types of interaction with this framework. End users can actually download apps and look at their own lives and analyze it. We also want to help researchers who are non-technical to actually do experiments like this. And we also want to give tools for developers to build on it and actually make new apps that have this type of data. So if we look at the different what we have for each of these groups, so end users, you know, can ask questions about their own lives. How active are you? How are you sick or not? How are you sleeping? You can actually review your life, which is part of this whole trend of quantified self and things like this that is really rising. So we actually have an app in the Android market called FUNF Journal, which allows you to collect and export and analyze your own data. So the idea is that you can download this app and actually choose what you want to collect out of the 30-something types of signals that we give. And the phone automatically collects them and encrypts them on your phone. And then we give people several ways to get data out of the phone, like with a USB cable, sending it through an email, you know, if you're not technical at all. Or you can set up a server that will automatically get all the data for you. And then when it's aggregated, we actually give a program that you run and just decrypts it and just sets it all up for you and gives you some example visualizations of what you can do with your own information. And so this is some examples of some of the visualizations that you can do about movement activity, and we also have location and things like this. Where this is going is, if you can imagine, so the next versions that we're working on will do things like, if this is a picture that you want to take, you're down the street and take a picture, today the camera attaches maybe the time and date and the geographic coordinates of where you were. But using data on the phone, you can actually enrich the picture much more. You can see your track of movement when you were doing this. You can see what apps you were running at the time. You can actually see who was physically with you. You can see the pictures that they took around the same time. You can look at the volume around you and actually infer if you're outside or inside or you're in an event or something like this. And all this richness is going to come that is to expose this up from the phone into the user, into the realm of the users. For researchers, especially non-technical researchers, we have FUNF in a box. which is a service that where you can build an app or an experiment in 5 minutes with zero coding. So it's actually an integration app with Dropbox, and you just go to a website, you approve a Dropbox app, you fill in what exactly data, what you want to collect, and information about your study, you press a button, and suddenly it just fills up your own Dropbox account with all the information and all the files you need, plus creates an automatic Android app that you can install on all the phones that you want to collect data from. And the idea is that the phones will automatically use your Dropbox as a server, so no technical or IT needed. And a lot of psychologists are starting to use this now to do some experiments about, you know, collecting data, doing behavioral and psychological experiments right now. On the developer end, that's where we're really focused. So it's a really high barrier of entry to do these sort of things. You know, big companies with a lot of money can invest in this, but not the everyday, you know, single developer. There's also no standardized data formats between all these types of things, and no other open source alternatives that we had when we started working on this. So our goal is to democratize data-driven applications. We want to make it cheaper to build apps with Phanof than from scratch. We want to have any new code that people add contribute to the database rather than duplicate the existing functionality that we already had. We want the platform to allow you to share functionality, and we want to embed the user protection and control into all of this. So all of our philosophy about protecting the users will be embedded in this framework, or is already embedded in this framework. So the general idea is that you can just embed Phanof as a library in your application and automatically get access to all the sensors on your phone, a lot of inferences that people have been contributing, plus it takes care of encryption and backing it up and sending it to a server and all those sort of things. And if we look at the vision, we hope this to be sort of, the internet had the hourglass model where TCP/IP in the middle sort of unified all the platforms below and above. And hopefully Phanof or something, a collaboration with other organizations could actually make sort of a unified framework to actually aggregate data types and actually, you know, computer scientists could develop new algorithms and new methods that will automatically propagate through the stack because of the shared data structures where end users and researchers and anybody else could actually use them in their apps. We launched this publicly in October with almost zero advertisements. We won 2 Google Research Awards to develop this with over $150,000 to improve this open source project. We're presenting in the Accelerator, in the Southwest Southwest Accelerator on Monday to try to, again, turn this into a non-profit organization to support this. We have over 100 market downloads, again, of the research application. And we have, again, hundreds of apps being built with this right now with a growing community. I think for me, one of the most gratifying things is to start seeing other people answer questions in the forum about this, and people writing us that they're writing their thesis with this already, and it saved them a lot of time. So it's really gratifying to actually, you know, put this in the real world and see how people use it. And people have already found, for example, security bugs in it, which we already fixed. So that's the benefit of the open community versus doing it as a closed source product. And already, like I said, there are many types of there are many deployments and experiments already working with this framework. We got a little bit of news coverage, Wall Street Journal, Wired, some other places. But to summarize what we've talked about here right now. So I talked about the general social fMRI approach. So combining rich data, connect, and doing studies in the real world together with intervention. We have this fun framework that I mentioned, implemented and field tested and actually tried in the real world. We have the study that we've done. And finally, we have these initial results that we've found. But what really matters here is the platforms. So these are all platforms for innovation. Others can use our approach to do other experiments beside us. The system could be used to do many different things that we never even thought about. And again, there's many more findings that you could probably do in this data set that we will never have time in our lifetime to actually look into. So this is what really matters, what other people can do with the frameworks and platforms that we provide. So phanof.org is where you can find us on the web. There's a email if you want, or any questions or anything that you'd want, and we'll try to make all of this available and open. And I can take questions if there are any.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what drove your decision to use Android as the first mobile...
Can you please speak closer?
Yeah. Could you speak to what drove your decision to use Android as your initial mobile platform, and also do you have plans to extend this to iOS?
Okay. Yeah, so all about cost effectiveness. At the time we got to work on this, Android was spread enough in the world And it's because it's such an open platform, it allows us to do this. You know, two developers alone, we could actually build this whole thing for the experiment with a little help from others. We could have never done this with iOS or other frameworks. And we looked at the trajectory of Android and decided to bet all our time in it because we saw it as a growing platform that's growing in many places. You could do some of these right now in iOS without hacking and rooting the phone, but it doesn't really give it to you out of the box. Android allows you out of the box access to everything in the system, and that's the big benefit. So we're already working with several other researchers who are trying to port some of this into iOS and into web apps, and this is where the framework comes in the data structure. So we actually, because the way the data is formatted is open, you can extend this whole architecture into many other frameworks, and the data could all be used by the same apps. So we're working on that as well.
Hi. You said that you wanted to measure how people being exposed to their own data changed their behavior. I was wondering if it did, and also how.
Could you please speak closer to me?
So you wanted to see if exposing people to their own data changed their behavior.
Yeah.
But I don't think I saw an example of whether it happened and how and what the impact of that was.
So we're actually still analyzing this data right now. So we're working on a publication exactly on this type, but we don't have existing results to show. I can tell you about myself, and I was doing everything as a guinea pig on myself as well, and just looking at my own recorded mood and sleep times, and I could actually see how my stress changes and how my eating behavior changes, and looking at my movement, I know it changed something, and now I want to measure it and actually look at it in a much better way. And I even knew this was being done. We want to actually look at the people who didn't know all this testing was going on. But we don't have the specific results to publish yet.
Is there a sign-up for this?
So hopefully in the next 6 months we'll be able to publish it. But again, it's the research, just finding the interesting things to get out of the data. And again, I think this data set will be analyzed for many, many years into the future and help many PhD theses because it's so rich. But it's just going to take us time. We're trying to find the ways to share it in a way that doesn't hurt the people's privacy. So right now you actually have to come under the MIT umbrella to actually look at this data so you can actually get through all the training and how to protect the data. It's never going to be public in the internet, right? Well, if there are no other questions, then thank you very much.